alright. Alright, alright, so here we are. Living it day by day, you are a superstar. And he says what she used to always say.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of OWW Radio. This is the official radio program of OnlineWorldOfWrestling.com. Each week, OWW Radio will provide perspective on WWE, TNA, and everything else making news in the world of professional wrestling. This week, we will discuss a plethora of things with my guest, Wrestling Observer, Los Angeles Times, SureDog.com, a multitude of websites on the internet, a contributor to all, Todd Martin. How are you doing this week, Todd?
I'm doing good. How are you, Alex?
I'm doing very, very well. And while this is predominantly a pro wrestling podcast, I first want to start the show off by talking to you about what some are calling one of the greatest title fights of all time. This past Saturday, the Ultimate Fighting Championship had John Jones against Alex Gustafsson. Not a lot of hype going in for the fight per se, but coming out of it, a lot of people were excited about that fight and the potential of there being a rematch. Todd, I guess, where do you rank this in your echelon of the fighting?
I thought it was a great fight. I guess I'll have to wait a little bit to sort of get a little distance to sort of think about where it ranks. Admittedly, my reflexive reaction to talk about being the greatest fight of all time is to kind of scoff. I don't think it's at that level. At the level of, like, say, Vanderlei Silva, Rampage Jackson, too. But I thought it was an absolutely tremendous fight. There's no question it's going to be one of the most talked about fights of the year, and, you know, one of the fights of the year, and, you know, just about everyone considering the fights of the year, it's going to, you know, it's at least going to be one of the top two or three, if not the winner. It was just a really exciting back and forth struggle between two high level fighters. It was a very well fought fight, and like an Anderson Silva versus Chael Sonnen fight, I think, or a Randy Couture versus Tim Sylvia fight, I think it benefits from what an interesting story it told. I think sort of the best fights are ones where you get some sort of story behind it, and John Jones is a guy who throughout his career has really controlled the vast majority of his fights. We've all talked about Lyoto Machida doing a little bit against him, but really Machida didn't do much at all. And Vito Belfort did get the armbar briefly, but Jones dominated the rest of that fight. And other than that, he's just been obliterating dudes. And he went in there with a guy who gave him everything he could handle, just really was taking it to him, busted up his face, you know, gave him huge problems, and about 19 minutes into a 25-minute fight, John Jones was on the cusp of losing his title, and he needed something desperate. He needed, based on the judges' scorecards at that point, he needed to somehow manage to win a round that he was way behind in and win the next round, and he came back firing. He really damaged Alexander Gustafsson in that fourth round. That fifth round, he just turned it on, and he ran past Alexander Gustafsson and really took over the fight. So it was a fight where John Jones, it was a legacy fight, a fight where John Jones was confronted with adversity in a way that he never had before, and he came through with fine colors. And that's sort of that to me is, you know, what is great about sports. You get these competitors who are at a very, very high level, and you test them out, and some of them aren't able to come through when the going gets tough, and some of them are. And the ones who are the ones who are truly great. And, you know, I think you can really have a lot of respect for guys who are really good, like a John Jones, really talented, but I don't feel like you've really learned all there is to know about them until you see what happens when the going gets tough. And Alexander Gustafsson gave John Jones everything he had, and John Jones was still able to pull out a very, very close win. I thought it was a tremendous fight.
So John Jones went into the fight saying that he worked a lot on his boxing instead of his wrestling, and we saw the disparity in John Jones. Until the later rounds, wasn't able to take down Alexander Gustafsson, but in the early rounds, Alexander Gustafsson took him down a few times. But when I look at John Jones' boxing, against the, you had an awesome tweet, I think, during the fight where you said, you know, maybe there is something to the narrative about how important the range is to Jones' success. And I think that came into play a lot during his striking. When you look at a lot of his fights, he utilized range very well. But against Gustafsson, it almost looked like he had no fundamental boxing. Instead, it looked like he resorted. It reminds me a lot of, I guess, like a Utah against Oklahoma a few years ago comes to mind, where they ran a very trick-related offense toward the end of the game, and that's what that game is remembered for. And Jones, it looks like he throws a lot of Hail Marys, but doesn't have a lot of setups. What are your thoughts on, did we see anything with John Jones striking against Gustafsson?
Well, he's very unorthodox, specifically because he does have that range and he's able to use that range so much. And he uses a lot of tactics that he just wouldn't be able to use against guys that have the exact same range as him. And some of those tools are very useful in winning fights. Like, take the Rashad Evans fight. Like, he was constantly using these little short elbows. And Rashad Evans just had no answer for these little short elbows. And very few people use that technique, these little short elbows, in the way that John Jones was. And it was specifically because he did have that big range advantage over Rashad Evans. He didn't throw any of those against Alexander Gustafsson, and it was specifically because he couldn't, because if he was, you know, got close enough to Alexander Gustafsson to try to throw one of these little short elbows, he was right in range for Alexander Gustafsson's power punches. So, I mean, his game has always been built on those natural those natural advantages that he has in the 205 division. And when you pull those back a little bit, you know, it takes away some of his game, and he had to make adjustments, and he had to plan around the fact that he wasn't able to do exactly what, is usually what he's able to take advantage of.
And the only reason I say this, because I have a ton positive to say about the fight, but the only negative takeaway was the striking, because during the International World Tour, where UFC took the biggest headliners from the rest of this year, took them around the world for multiple press conferences, I remember seeing a photo from one of the press conferences where John Jones did a face-to-face with Cain Velasquez. John Jones, during the media before this fight, said he would be interested in taking a heavyweight fight, possibly as soon as next year. Jones, his striking against guys like Cain Velasquez and Junior Dos Santos, I think that it could potentially limit his effectiveness at heavyweight if he doesn't have a variety of if he doesn't have a more effective striking game. Do you see that at all? Or
I think there's some validity to that, but I mean, you've also got to take into account the quality of the opponent. I mean, Gustafsson is an excellent striker. That's always been his strength. He's a big guy with big range with very solid striking. Nobody has ever beaten him at that game. So, and John Jones, I mean, you can sort of argue whether he did or he didn't, but because, I mean, a lot of it was sort of cardio, but John Jones fought the majority of five rounds standing, and he got the Duke over this guy, a guy who's an excellent striker. So, I mean, I think that Gustafsson, in spite of fighting in a lower division, in some ways is probably more of a threat as a striker than Cain Velasquez. Is he more of a threat than Junior Dos Santos? No. But I don't think John Jones is going to go in there looking to strike with Junior Dos Santos. I think he's going to look to take the fight to the ground. And the question then is whether what happened against Gustafsson, where he wasn't able to get him down consistently, was something of an anomaly or, something of a trend. And, you know, John Jones' wrestling throughout his career has been excellent, but he also hasn't been tested that much. There haven't been a lot of guys that have just sort of gone for takedown after takedown on him. Have really had, elite defensive wrestlers trying to stop his takedown. So I think it's an open question whether John Jones would be able to impose his wrestling as well in the heavyweight division as some people sort of thought going into the Gustafsson fight, although I don't want to overplay the point. I mean, Jones has excellent wrestling, and I don't think by any means was this exposition of severe flaws. He went in there with a really good fighter who fought on top of his game, and he still won.
John Jones had to dig deep, like you said, in the later rounds, and took the fight from Gustafson, took everything Gustafson had. There was that moment, I believe, in the fourth round where Gustafson received a head kick, and it looked like he was out on his feet, and then he brought himself back, and that's one of the moments I think I'll remember 10, 15, 20 years from now from that fight, is when Gustafson was knocked out and brought himself back. Is the what would you assign a percentage to John Jones coming back scarier at 205 pounds, considering he just went through this war?
Well, I think it's sort of difficult for him to be any more scary, given that he went into this fight with, as we said, a guy who had like a 17 or 18-1 record, and was blowing through people. And you know, Jones went in there as a minus, you know, 500 or something favorite. I mean, John Jones has been looking as good as anyone has ever looked in MMA history. So, you know, his ability to sort of move it, you know, move it, take it to another level. I mean, I don't know if, you know, I don't know how realistic that is, but will he come out there, make adjustments, and clean up some of the issues that were in there before? Yes. Do I think he'll be a better fighter? Yes. I think, you know, there's still plenty of room for him to grow as a fighter. But there's also the flip side, which is that, you know, other people are also getting better, and other people are also learning from, you know, from the holes and from the vulnerabilities that open up. And we've frequently seen throughout MMA history that guys will look invincible. We've seen this time and time and time again with everyone from, you know, Mark Coleman to Mark Kerr to Vanderlei Silva to Miracle Krokop to Fedor Emelianenko to Chuck Liddell. Guys will look, Tito Ortiz, guys will look, pretty much every big name in the sport. They'll go through a period where people are thinking of them as basically invincible because of how impressive they're looking. And then a few flaws will come through. And once other guys sort of find the little tricks to getting by that person, frequently you'll see guys move a few steps down because in MMA there's so many different ways to win a fight that if you can hone in on a weakness in a guy, you can really find a way to exploit it in the way that you can't necessarily in an enterprise where there aren't so many different ways to win. So will he be better vis-a-vis the other people in his division after this? I mean, that's going to be a difficult task. But I do think he's going to learn from this fight. And I think he, in a vacuum, is going to become a better fighter.
Yes, and that's, that's the aspect that he has a lot of things going for, right? So Dana White and a lot of the press he's been doing recently, whenever he's asked the question about John Jones' maturation, he always says that John Jones experienced success at an early age, which is unquestionable. I mean, you can just look at his age, and how, when he won the title, it's obvious he got it at a very young age. So he's hitting a point where he's maturing as an adult. And secondly, going through a fight where he was pushed for the first time ever in his career, I think that the potential is that we may not have a metric to measure how much more scary, I guess, John Jones has gotten. But I think that for the next 2 years, John Jones might be the scariest fighter at any weight class in the UFC. And maybe he would have achieved that anyways, right? But with the Gustafson fight, definitely has a little bit more motivation to achieve a higher level.
Yeah, and to be fair, like when you talk about the maturation process of John Jones, I think the ways that he can mature as a person in the coming years, I think more relate to the way that he deals with other people and the way that he carries himself. You know, there's sort of a perception among a lot of people, but he doesn't present his full authentic self to the public. He's trying to be something else, and I think over time, that's the sort of thing that I can think he can learn from and mature. As a fighter, I don't think that there's immaturity in his game. I think he's been a remarkably composed, devoted, and a student of the game in his career. So when Dana talks about the maturation process of John Jones, I think of that more in terms of his public persona and public relations. I don't think of that as much as a fighter. I think he'll make adjustments more just because he'll learn a lot from somebody actually taking it to him. You can learn a lot more from that than a fight where you just control things. It shows sort of the right things to tighten up and the right ways to improve yourself. But I don't think by any means John Jones needs some sort of overhaul of the way that he approaches fighting. I think in that regard, he's a completely, you know, a very, very well-developed person and a, you know, very much devoted to his game. I think, you know, I was sort of worried coming out of this fight, we were going to get the narrative from some people that John Jones was taking Alexander Gustafsson lightly. And luckily, I haven't heard very much of that because it would be a completely stupid argument. John Jones was losing the fight early on, and he came on hard in the final rounds and won from behind because he was in such good condition. And his conditioning was the difference, more so than anything else, along with his heart, in winning this fight. And the fact that he went in there in better condition and took over in the final rounds when he's been the champion, he is the big favorite, in there against a guy who was fighting in the biggest fight of his life and had more motivation than ever before, speaks to his work ethic, speaks to his devotion to his craft as a fighter. And that, I don't feel, needs a lot of work.
There's a potential opponent down the line for John Jones, Daniel Cormier. I'll get this in real quick. And Daniel Cormier is a potential future opponent for John Jones. Cain Velasquez is going into what is the biggest fight of his career. And I think it's kind of unfortunate matchmaking and the timing, because I think this is the biggest fight in UFC heavyweight history, the Cain Velasquez, Junior Dos Santos third fight. And I think it's sandwiched in between too many other important fights. I think it's kind of missing its meaning, but Dave, their gym, the American Kickboxing Academy, is affiliated with Checkmat, which is one of the top jiu-jitsu academies in the world. And currently one of the best grapplers, Marcus Almeida, has been training extensively with Daniel Cormier and Cain Velasquez as he prepares for Abu Dhabi, and they prepare for their upcoming fights. And I expect Cain and Daniel both to come out better grapplers, if that's even possible, training with Buchecha. So I'm very excited to see that in the future. What are your thoughts on, I guess, the third fight between Cain and Junior? Do you share my sentiment that I guess that it's kind of sandwiched in between other fights? People aren't really taking this for as important of a fight as it's going to be, or what are your opinions?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's going to be as much interest as it sort of feels like there ought to be. Although I don't know necessarily if it's an issue of sandwiching, although I think that contributes. I think the bigger issue is just the way the two fights have gone. And it's sort of unfortunate in the sense that, like, these are two evenly matched fighters who are right at the top of their games, and they've just been, you know, they've been taking out everyone else in their division, with the exception of each other. And it's sort of a unique dichotomy. There aren't a lot of divisions in MMA history that we've ever seen like this, where you've got two guys who have so clearly defined themselves above everyone else and just have been taking out everyone else, having neither of them have really had any trouble in any of their fights with the exception of fighting each other. That's a really interesting dynamic, and it makes the fight big, but it just suffers from the basic fact that the first fight, Junior Dos Santos knocked him out, you know, cold and quickly, and the second fight, Cain Velasquez just destroyed him for 25 minutes. So after the first fight, I think a lot of people were thinking, boy, you know, there's really no reason to expect Cain Velasquez to do any better this time, because we just saw the fight and Junior Dos Santos knocked him out. And after the second fight, it's like, boy, there's no reason to expect anything other than Cain Velasquez mauling the guy for 25 minutes, because we just saw that. And the memory of the first fight seems almost sort of like a puncher's chance situation more than anything else. So I think the way the fights went down is the biggest obstacle to capturing the public's imagination in a greater way.
Let's talk about pro wrestling. I'm not as excited currently about the state of professional wrestling, I guess, because the Ultimate Fighting Championship is embarking on its 20th anniversary, I guess, kind of second half of the year. And November 1993 was their first show. And I live close to Sacramento, and I'll be able to attend a show they're promoting in Sacramento, which will be UFC on Fox 9. And even that show has an incredible lineup on paper and a lot to get excited about. And right now, with it being the fall season, TNA, as they approach the biggest show of their year in World Wrestling Entertainment, I can't find even close to the same level of excitement.
Oh, come on now. Battleground, RVD versus ADR2? That's going to be a big fight feel, as Michael Cole would say.
Yes, Rob Van Dam versus Alberto Del Rio. Is Ricardo Rodriguez still in Rob Van Dam's corner?
As far as I know at this point. I mean, I was thinking they might put him on a poll for this one.
Rob Van Dam, now, do you believe that, because he had a lot of excitement when he first came back to the company, do you believe that they've overplayed their hand when it comes to Rob Van Dam, that they should have used them sparingly?
Interesting question. Yeah, I guess it kind of, if they'd used them more sparingly, it might have worked better, in the sense that I think people were so excited for RVD because of the memory of how exciting he was at his peak. And he isn't that guy anymore. So it was naturally only going to be able to go so far because, you know, he isn't that guy that he was at, you know, at 27 when he was, you know, very much reliant on his athleticism. So, I haven't thought about it, but I think that they would have been better off using him a little bit less, and thus people would be thinking more in terms of their memory of Rob Van Dam than in terms of, you know, what he is now.
I've always believed that in wrestling that you can't really make a new top guy until the old top guy leaves. When Hulk Hogan left, we had the rise of Bret Hart. I guess Bret Hart was still around for Steve Austin, but Steve Austin didn't really take off. Well, Steve Austin really didn't take off until Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart left. That's an accurate statement. Now, John Cena's gone, and I think a lot of people expected a lot of inventory to be put into Daniel Bryan, and I don't think we've seen a lot put into him as far as television time, as far as attention when it comes to storylines. But do you believe that they've put enough investment into Daniel Bryan to where people will see him at another level when John Cena returns?
Well, first, I disagree with your premise. I think that in wrestling, you're better off using the guys that you have there to get over new guys. And while I think there are counterexamples of guys who have gotten over when the other guys have departed, I think there are also tons and tons of examples of guys that have benefited from being essentially passed the torch from the guy beforehand. I think that's the optimal situation, whether it's Jumbo Tsuruta passing the torch to Mitsuru Misawa, or Harley Race passing the torch to Ric Flair, or, you know, Andre the Giant. That wasn't as much of a torch, but sort of the guy that was sort of the iconic figure of a generation before passing that on to Hulk Hogan. I think that in general, you're a lot better off if you have the guy that everyone perceives to be the top guy lose to the guy who's your next top guy, and then you try to keep them both as being important figures, but you use it as a way to tell people, oh, this new guy is the guy to really push the hardest. And I guess there's sort of a difficulty of doing that with John Cena and Daniel Bryan, and it might be better to not have John Cena there because they're not ready to pass the torch in that way. If they were ready to, you know, really focus on Daniel Bryan or someone else over John Cena, then it might be a good situation to have John Cena there to help get this next guy over to the next level. But given they don't really have that mentality, in that case, maybe it's better to have John Cena gone because then you just don't have the contrast of having to worry about this other guy who they clearly view as a top guy contrasted to this other guy who they're sort of behind, but not really all the way behind. As far as the way they've used Daniel Bryan, I think they've done a pretty good job. I think they could have done a better job in some ways, in a number of ways, actually. But I think overall, they've made a concerted, good faith effort to try to get this guy over to a high level. They've given him a lot of big wins over, quality opposition. They've featured him as the prominent part of the show. They've given a lot of different things to the guy to try to get him to that next level. I don't know how well that will be taken when Cena comes back, simply because when Cena comes back, I think they're just going to put Cena over him, not in the sense of having Cena beat him, but in the sense of having Cena featured in more prominent roles on the card at that point. So at that point, it sort of unwinds some of the traction that they've gained to this point. But it's not like they've had a roaring success with Daniel Bryan during this time period. I think it's been sort of a qualified success. I would liken, we've brought up Bret Hart before, I would liken it to Bret Hart's first run more so than, say, Steve Austin, where, you know, things aren't hot by any means, and Bret Hart, you know, things weren't going hot, but things were sort of, you know, they were doing okay. They were plateaued. They were doing better than one might expect, given that you were moving from, you know, Hogan and Flair and Savage as your top guys into Bret Hart, who had to that point been an Intercontinental Champion, and sort of a similar deal with Daniel Bryan. He's a guy that, you know, they've given him the equivalent of the Intercontinental title with that World Heavyweight title run, but they haven't really, you know, they hadn't really made him the focus of anything until just, you know, over this year. So I think it's unrealistic to expect a guy who's been, you know, featured at a lower level for such a long period of time to, you know, sort of instantaneously be taken seriously as a tippy top guy.
Now, on the competition brand, TNA Impact Wrestling, we've seen AJ Styles' ascension to where he's challenging Bully Ray for the title at their biggest show of the year, Bound for Glory. What do you think about the way AJ Styles has been featured and his moving to, I guess, this big role where he's challenging Bully Ray for the title?
I mean, it's been quite the ride. I don't know if I'd call it an ascension so much as you sort of, you know, you stop into a plane with no, you know, with very limited fuel, you take off and then you see what happens. I mean, it's been all over the place. I mean, I like some of the ideas they've had, right? Like the idea of using him sort of as a Sting figure, because I think the basic dynamic of Sting worked very well, and we haven't seen that a lot with other guys, where you took this guy who was, he was on one side of this big war, and then he sort of becomes a rebel, the guy on the outside, the guy who doesn't have allegiances, and then he comes out there, and he comes to sort of, you know, vindicate the right side and take care of the bad guys. I think that's sort of a classic story, and I think they started it out in a way that that could have worked. The problem is there have been too many missteps along the way. And sort of the two biggest ones in my mind were, number one, they didn't angle one week. And I forget who it was, but I think it was Kurt Angle. It might have been Sting. And they did this angle where the Aces and Eights wanted AJ Styles to hit this guy with a hammer. And he hit the guy with a hammer, and then he turned on Aces and Eights. And I think he should have just turned on Aces and Eights. I think at the point there where he's still, you know, hitting a babyface who isn't defending himself with a hammer, like, it was like, this guy isn't someone that you really want to get behind. And then the other was obviously the promo that he did, trying to explain his actions when he finally seemed like he turned face and gone back to the old AJ Styles. And he cut sort of a whining promo that the fans really turned on. And I think those were the two sort of key moments in him not really being taken the way that I think they wanted him to be taken. He just wasn't sort of the real sort of savior that I think the role called for. So, I mean, I don't give them high marks at all for the way that they've handled AJ Styles overall.
What's that? What's interesting is that TNA, right, in 2000, I have my years off, but the early days of TNA, they were able to gain interest by wrestling fans who wanted more professional wrestling, guys who watched independent wrestling tapes. And the thing that appealed to them about TNA was not only the weekly pay-per-views, but I expected a laugh out of that. And so not only did the weekly pay-per-views appeal to the hardcore wrestling fan, but the fact that independent wrestling talent was being featured. A lot of those early tapings, we saw Low Key, AJ Styles, Christopher Daniels, Amazing Red, SAT. And WWE was always the people that shut their doors to the independent wrestling talent, or at least that was the perception. And now fast forward all these years later, and it seems like, well, I don't think that only seems like. I think the fact is that independent wrestling talent feel more comfortable trying their luck at World Wrestling Entertainment than TNA. And I was wondering what your thoughts are on that. Is that a what are your thoughts on that in general? And do you think you would have expected that looking back historically?
Yeah, I mean, they dropped the ball. I mean, what more can you say? They had an opportunity a number of years back when the indie scene was loaded with very, very marketable talent. And I don't feel like this is, you know, I don't think this is an issue of sort of looking back with, you know, sort of 2020 vision and, you know, sort of creating something that wasn't. I think it was quite evident, if you were following the indie scene at that point, that there were a lot of guys there that were more talented than very strong featured performers on the national stage embedded in TNA. And those guys could have been had by TNA if they had, you know, decided to open up their checkbooks and sign those guys rather than sort of the WWE retreads that they signed. And if they built around those new guys, they could have had a lot of the guys that WWE has built around. And instead, they let WWE scoop up all these guys. And now they're at a point where WWE has raided, you know, those guys. And from, you know, Daniel Bryan to Sami Zayn to Dean Ambrose to Seth Rollins he was a little bit earlier, but CM Punk, they've taken the best indie guys, and those guys are no longer available for TNA to scoop up. So I think it was a real missed opportunity, unfortunately. And it's, you know, it's nothing really they can do about it now. They've, you know, those guys, you know, the talent isn't out there in the way that it was back then.
I think that's the most unfortunate thing about the TNA story is that it could have been opposition, I guess, to World Wrestling Entertainment. I feel like TNA could have provided something different, not only by showcasing independent wrestling talent that may have not been seen by a wider audience, but then in a lot of their presentation. And it seems like they always went in that direction, but was kind of off with it. Because, you know, we make jokes about a lot of the historical TNA matches, right? Like the Battle Royal, where you go in the ring, not out of the ring. And it seems like TNA always tried to do something different than WWE, but it seems like they always missed the mark. And it's kind of interesting that the wrestling company always missed the mark and never really found its stride.
Yeah, well, I think there's a difference between finding sort of different weird gimmicks and being a genuine alternative. And I don't think that a lot of those wacky things that they did were really that much different than what WWE was doing. WWE had sort of a goofy tone as well at that point. You know, I think that they really should have focused more on the things that WWE wasn't doing altogether, or the things that WWE was weak on. And I don't think that, you know, having more goofy stipulation matches was a key way that they should have been distinguishing themselves from WWE.
Recently here in Reno, Nevada, we got Ring of Honor Television. This past Saturday was the first showing in this market. And I've actually not watched Ring of Honor. Last year's WrestleMania was the last time I watched a Ring of Honor show. And it was kind of a breath of fresh air, I must say, for a product that's kind of definitely not at the peak of its popularity with its fan base. I have to say, I enjoyed that particular television show, and I look forward to seeing a different wrestling company, I guess, presented on TV.
Yeah, I don't get the television here, but the television shows that I've been to up in Baltimore have generally been fun shows. I think ROH is really slipping. They really don't have a lot of, you know, things going in their direction, and I don't think they have the talent that they once did, but the booking is always competent. They have very good wrestlers overall in the ring, and they don't insult the intelligence. So it's a product that is very easy to digest, even if it's hard to fall in love with.
Yes, and sometimes I think all you need is something that is easy to ingest. I think that sometimes it's better than something that's revolutionary and groundbreaking, sometimes on television. Well, Todd, thank you very, very much for joining me this evening. And there was a lot of MMA talk, so hopefully the fans here at OWW Radio will find that discussion enjoyable as well. A lot of good discussion in that. Todd, I gave an example of some of the places people could find your work, LA Times, SureDog.com, WrestlingObserver.com. Todd does monthly ratings of MMA fighters for LA Times. And and from time to time, you'll do an article as well for LA Times?
That is correct. Yeah, I've got an article coming up on GRTV in the next couple weeks. So you can look for that there as well.
Interesting. And looking forward to reading that and your other work. Is there anything else coming up that you would like to discuss here?
Nothing I can think of.
Okay, great. I look forward to reading your Tito Ortiz article as well. And don't forget to check out the OWW website at onlineworldofwrestling.com for the latest news, analysis, and updates from the world of professional wrestling. While you're there, you can also catch up on past episodes of OWW Radio. You can email us at radio@onlineworldofwrestling.com to submit topics or questions you would like us to discuss on an upcoming broadcast. Also, make sure to follow us on Twitter at OWWCOM to get all program updates and announcements. We will be posting this directly to the official OWW Facebook homepage. Until next time, this is Alex, and we've hoped you enjoyed the program. And we'll be back soon with another edition of OWW Radio. All right, well, that's the way.